What I came ready so is to do some very basics on the culture, and I might be telling you something you already know, so I hope not. But anyway, so I'm not here so much as an expert on Hinduism. I don't come from a Hindu background and didn't write a lot of papers on Hinduism. But I got two things going for me. One is I actually grew up in East Africa when I was young, and then I lived in this Portuguese colony in India. So I had to come to Hinduism, you know, just the way you would probably, like as a newbie, as an outsider. I had to learn about it without having had any cues that I kind of inherited or understood. I had to observe and study and figure things out. And so I feel like I've got a perspective that I can then share, because when you're within it, sometimes you don't know how to describe your culture. I often notice people coming back from India, they have these like amazing photographs of India, and I'm like, I never think of taking those photographs, because to me it's like, yeah, the cars on the road and the shops, you know, it's just normal, correct? And I come back and I don't have these photographs of India, so to speak, because I can't see it. And the other thing is, I just found out that Hina also studied architecture, but my college years was in Bombay, and pretty much in my the college I went to, we had 500 students in my grade. I was the only Christian, and as I went to architecture college, I think there were two Christians in the whole college, and so I very much had lots of Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist friends growing up. And as I got saved in my second year studying architecture, my concern was very much for these friends. I'm like, oh, as you know, people from a Christian background get to hear the gospel so many times in so many ways, but my friends never get this chance. Many of them may live a block away from a church or church building, but that doesn't mean they've heard the gospel. Doesn't mean they've heard it in a way they can understand. So that got me into YWAM and got me into church planting. That's where I worked at for 25 years. Doing this, and you know, but personally, always wanting to share faith, whether it's trains, planes, automobiles, parks, wherever I could, and there was a chance to, you know, share faith with my friends and family and people I met, I would do it. So I bring, you know, I'll be sharing some things out of that experience, and would love to, you know, answer questions even related to that. So let me see if this thing works. Okay. So this is just a dictionary definition of culture, and what I liked about it is it talks about the way of life, and that's some of the things I'm going to, you know, just hit at a bit. And I like the fact that it talks about the ordinary behavior and habits. So I'm not going into very rare, exotic rituals that Hindus practice, but very ordinary behavior and habits, so that can be a help, you know, for you as you deal with students. Okay, so here's a quick question for you, stream of consciousness, quickly. When you think of Hindus or India, what images come to your mind? Quickly, there's no wrong answer. Anyone? Okay, Indian food. Anyone else? Many gods, okay. Lots of color. Anything else? The dots on the head, okay. Chaos. There's lots said about the traffic. Big weddings, okay. Lots of ceremonies. Oh, yeah, they're good. So what sort of questions do these usually prompt? Like we have like two Indians here. I'm gonna, you know, pull on that. So what sort of a question, because of these images where people may have, what sort of questions do people ask you about India? Any come to mind? Yeah? Okay. Okay. What about you, Hina? What sort of Yes. Okay. So you probably get the same kind of question again. So y'all have pointed out some good images, but some of the images people have is very much like poor children, starving children, the slums, dilapidated buildings, the crumbling infrastructure, corruption. And so on and so forth. And then, you know, you get questions like, I've had people ask me, so do you all have roads, like roads or colleges, universities? Do people live in homes? Are they like regular homes? And the elephants, definitely. So on and so forth. Yeah, because you have certain images and then they fuel certain questions, correct? And by the way, I once made fun of the whole elephant thing, but then one day I was back in Pune, which is a city, a big city, a very big city, and I was just walking around my neighborhood and there was this elephant on the road. And I'm like, wow, you know, we do see elephants and camels at weird places, even in a city in India, which you would never do over here. So there is this lady, Chimamanda, I'm not saying her name well, Ngozi Adichie. Anyway, she's Nigerian. She has, if you YouTube, she's talked about this, the danger of a single story. And in that, she talks about, have you seen that? Okay. And she talks about these images that people have that are very one-sided, which she calls like a single story. And sometimes there's been like that single story of India that fuels all the questions, fuels, you know, kind of things we ask people, we talk about. That can just be difficult for some of the Indians, like, okay, you're in this box. And sometimes the missionaries, people like ourselves, we come back and we're always showing pictures, maybe of the poor, because so much of Christian missions does happen among the poor, does happen among the Dalits or the low-caste Hindus. And so you get those sort of pictures. But those are not the people that y'all will usually be dealing with in IFI. And there is not a lot of resources and examples and strategies out there for the very more middle, upper class Indians that y'all will deal with. And so if you only have this perspective of the poor and the slums, you know, you're going to sort of rub them off the wrong way. So this is something that I hope to leave with you, is the observe, ask, listen, affirm, and bridge. Because Hindu culture is so diverse, there's no way I can cover every aspect of it, and you would not even remember that. But to begin listening, as you build relationships, start listening, start asking, observing, and then affirm. Okay, I like to talk about that because that was my hardship. When you cross cultures, see, we're kind of hardwired to compare everyone to our culture and then criticize. You know, because it's not as good. So you go for this Indian wedding, maybe, and everyone's in fully decked out with glittering gold, diamonds, shiny clothes with very loud colors. And we're like, oh, you know, the hair was great, but it was very showy and very gaudy or very, you know. We may eat Indian food and think, oh, yeah, it was too spicy. I couldn't taste the food I was eating. It was all the spices. Or we might go meet some people and say, they were so loud. But these Indian people in the restaurant, they were too loud. You know, they should learn better manners. So that's typically how we kind of operate, because we compare something to our culture and then we're like, you know. But we are the same way, okay? Indians are the same way. They come here, they look at things in America and they say, oh, you know, Americans, they don't have the family values we have, or they don't give attention to food like we do, or they don't value relationships. You know, we all have our stereotypes, okay? So the idea here now is to break away from the stereotypes, and even what I share with you today can become, I don't want that to become part of your stereotype, but to say, okay, I'm going to see how to listen, and what can I affirm, okay? One story I have about affirmation is when I was first newly married and I came back home, my mother-in-law was like probably in her 70s at that time. Anyway, so we were like four of us, the two of us and our two boys, and, you know, so she's got all these meals to make, and we were sitting down to this wonderful Mennonite cooking that she'd done, and I was eating this loaf of whole wheat bread. And then she casually mentioned that she had baked that bread the previous year and had pulled it out, you know, and warm, you know, baked in oven. And she also mentioned that about another dish that she had made a couple of months ago and frozen. And I was like, okay. Yeah, like I would rather have not known that, you know. But you know, I had gone through our church planning training on culture, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to think this is different. You know, I want to criticize maybe, but it's like, this is different. And I'm curious now. I'm curious, why is it different? Why why would he have this this situation? Hey, come, Smita. And I've learned to turn it around and affirm that, because in India, current goes all the time. And if you try to bake something and keep it for 6 months in your freezer, it would be in terrible condition, because by the time the current has gone off and on and thing is frozen and thawed, it would be terrible. And I began to say, okay, here's this 70-year-old woman who's hosting us and feeding us all these lovely hot meals. But the way she did it, she planned ahead, she cooked things, she froze some things, and she's organized. She doesn't have the maids and household help that we have in India. And this is good, you know. I need to get over whatever my feelings about frozen food or food cooked. Yeah. So to turn it around and begin to affirm, to understand, and then be able to affirm and mimic her. So yeah. So I'm going to cover a few things in these areas. Time permits. Oh, this was a picture that I originally wanted with the images of India. So we often also have people with costumes and, you know, big elaborate, and then you might be disappointed as you meet your international student and find they're wearing T-shirts and jeans, and you know, because these are some of the pictures. This is a picture from the movie Slumdog Millionaire, and that's another movie that kind of shapes our paradigm a bit. And I don't know whether y'all get questions about it. Oh, people say, I saw Slumdog Millionaire and I want to talk about it. My free tip for today, don't go there. See some other movies. Because that's like everyone wanting to come to you and say, hey, what about racism in US? You know, I saw 12 Days a Slave or whatever, 12 Years a Slave. Or I saw, and that's all they, you know, want to talk about. Maybe move on. I'll give you some other Bollywood movies. Again, Slumdog was made by a British production company. It's not out of Bollywood, so it's a great movie though. But again, it feeds that one picture, the single story. So that's all I'm, you know, otherwise it's a good movie. So any talk of Hindu culture has to also begin with food. Now, this is common to many cultures, it's common to India as a whole, or Muslim cultures, but food is just a big part of the celebration. If you're going to celebrate something, you have food. You know, we talked about it, you know, inviting people to the satsang. Yeah, have food, because food is just an important way to say this is, we value you, this is important, it's relational. And for festivals, for example, people often make sweets and give it to their neighbors. And that's a way of, you know, inviting even Muslim and Christian neighbors to participate and celebrate with them in the festival. And that's a good thing to think of, that at Christmas time, you know, sending sweets to your Indian students or Indian neighbors or friends is a great way of drawing them in and saying, hey, we want to, you know, celebrate Christmas with you. I don't think that's something that normally you do in the States, correct? You don't give plates of sweets out, or does anyone? Yeah? Yeah? Okay. So like a cookie exchange, yes. So, what was I going to say? Hospitality. Again, I know with IFI, that's one of the ways you'll reach out to Indian students. And food is just an important part, because in India, they cook their food. We have like cooked meals, all three meals. And there's this whole phobia about leftover food. So I go to my very rich friends, they have these huge fridges, and the freezer will be empty, because maybe they don't eat meat, or if they do, they're not going to freeze it. And there'll be like this little box of ice cream maybe, and then the rest of the freezer is empty. And the fridge is also, our fridge never looks like that. The fridge will be like very few things, because there's this whole thing of you eat food fresh, you don't really eat leftovers. Somehow leftovers are supposed to magically disappear. I think mothers are supposed to eat them, or you give them, you know, somehow if you have a poor person working for you and you give them all your leftover food, but you do not offer leftover food to the guests. And if you do, as you might need to in America, you do not have to mention that. You don't have to say, oh, this is so great. I had this party yesterday, and now I have all this butter chicken left over, and you know, I'm so glad. Like, you know, it's not, I think that's my phone now. Is it okay? So don't mention it. Fresh food. Then they often have things like, if it's juta, okay? Anyone knows that concept? So it's like, you just like, you take a bite of an apple or a pie and say, oh, do you want some? And I'm like, Maybe not, you know, if you like we might do with someone who has a cold here, correct? You're not going to share a pie or double dip or, but sometimes Hindus are very particular about that. And I remember my son went through this phase. He had all these Hindu friends, and if you just offered him at home, you know, like none of us have a cold, and we offer him this piece of pie that we've taken a bite of, and he's like, no. Did you already take a bite? No, I can't eat it. And if you offered him something from our plate, he wouldn't eat it. Again, I don't know how strong that is still, but you can just keep that in mind and say, okay, you know, let's not go then. And I know you wouldn't probably do that with someone your first time or hosting anyway, but that's something to keep in mind, even as you build a relationship. So where am I? Okay, and then the famous thing that perhaps you'll have heard is, like, oh, I don't eat my food in front of other people and don't offer it because that's considered taboo. You might get you'll get a stomachache or you'll get sick. You should always offer, never eat in public, you know, in front of somebody, always offer what you're eating, share your food. But the opposite side of that is that if I know that if you're eating here, you have to share it with me culturally, then if I'm going to be polite, I have to say, no, don't worry, I'm okay. I already ate. I had some breakfast and came. But the understanding is if you really want to share it and it's not a problem, you would do what? Anyone knows? Yeah, you would insist. You would ask again. You would ask at least 2-3 times. And that's just, I mean, I've heard people talk about it. It seems like, oh, so silly, you know, with Indians, you have to ask them 3 times. Well, I would say it's a politeness because they're letting you off the hook by saying, no, I'm okay. But they're also like, if you don't do it, I've also heard people say, man, they were so rude. They brought up this whole box of cookies in front of me and then they just ate it. And I had missed lunch and they didn't even offer me. And actually, if you pursued, you'll say, well, actually they did offer. Yeah, but they said it once, which means that they didn't really want me to have it, you see? So this is a good thing to keep in mind because of the hosting and sharing. So when taking someone out, you know, to a restaurant, or if you're going to have something you want, you know, just insist a bit, because that would just be like normal asking. If you insist 3 times, that equals normal asking 1 time in America. So, okay, now be aware of fasting. So we invite people over to our homes, and we know what should not be on the menu. Beef, okay, we all mostly know that. It's like, okay, they don't eat beef. We're not going to have beef curry or beef burgers. But a good thing to ask is people are fasting. Okay, and again, with young students, I don't know how much they do that. But I noticed, like with my friends now, I go, they're like, they always have some fast going on. There's some festival. People worship Shiva in particular, like in the Shravan, the rainy season month, they'll fast every Monday. My sister-in-law is a Hindu. She'll have this fast for her husband. I wish she should be grateful. That's my brother. But suddenly, it's like she can't eat anything. She'll only eat yogurt with pomegranates and apples, which is nice and not too bad. But in the town my parents live in, well, it's difficult to find either pomegranates, yogurt, or apples at any given time. So, you know, as you're inviting people over, so it's not like they don't eat usually, but they, like, so this dish is called Sabudana Khichdi, and it's a dish in Maharashtra they often eat when they're fasting. So be aware, it's not like you have to produce all these things, but maybe by asking someone, you know, it's like, oh, do you have any special fasts, or is there something you will not eat, you know, based on the day of the week. So if you're inviting them on Wednesday or, you know, whatever, it might just be helpful to mention. The other 3 pictures are just pictures of all the foods that you're allowed to eat during the Navaratri. So Navaratri is this 9-day festival and people always fast. So just, you know, you're allowed these vegetables, these spices and nuts and those grains, and you don't have to remember that. Okay, we'll talk about respect and reverence. So this again is culture. Like for many of you, I guess you get called uncle and auntie, do you all sometimes? And how do you feel about that? Sometimes we don't want to be, even I don't want to be auntie and uncle. And it's like, oh no, have I gone that old? But that's like a respect. To call someone older than you by their name is just not cultural. You wouldn't do that in India. Even like in South India, even the younger brother doesn't call the older brother by name. They would say Anna or something. Or in other parts of India, the older sister is Didi. So this idea of like taking a name is very informal or very, you know, doesn't show respect. So it's not just about very old gray-haired people, but, you know, even in a joint family, you have certain names for the uncles or the brother-in-laws or the older brother-in-laws, and you would use those terms rather than just calling people by name. Yes, Lauren. Yeah. And it's hard because if you're trying to follow a story they're telling, and they're saying my mama and my mommy and my cha-cha and my cha-cha, and you're like, okay, which side is that? And I have to say that after all my years there, I still get that confused, because in Goa, where I come from, we have the same name. And it's like every time I think I mastered that. But it's a good thing if you're trying to follow the story, then say, okay, this is your dad's side. Okay, yeah, okay, I remember you mentioned this aunt before. So, I finished. I didn't do the respect, sorry.
You talked about elders and names.
Yes. Yes, sorry. So touching the feet is a tradition that children do with their parents as a sign of asking for blessing. Like someone who's in a dance class would touch the feet of their dance guru as a sign of respect, or your mentor, kind of get your blessing. And a lot of times the church would really encourage new believers that you have to stop this, because it's like you're worshiping the God in them. And there is that aspect in it, because Hinduism, you know, it does sort of respect God in everyone and in nature and everywhere, but we find this is a very important aspect of the culture, and it really sent the wrong message. And a lot of new Indian Christians just got into trouble with their family because they were seen as very disrespectful of the culture and the family and the parents, because they didn't seem to seek their blessing and didn't, What else? I talked a bit about the name. So. This is a protocol of how you know whose name you use. So people will probably use the auntie and uncle initially. And everyone has a pet name in India, and which they may or may not want you to use. But it's a real sign of intimacy, and it isn't like in America. So it isn't that a Christopher is Chris and a Patricia is Pat. It could be that you have a girl Sunita and her pet name is Pinky at home, or whatever, or Guddu or something. And that's fine. I think the idea is you go with their given names, because those are like usually names of intimacy that very close family and friends would use, and they're not sort of short forms. So I don't know whether any of the Indians here want to share their pet name. So left hand, again, conventions about not handling food, handing someone with a left hand, it's considered impure because people use their hand in the bathroom. And it's just considered polite to do things with your right hand, or even like with both hands. If you're giving someone a award or something special, you would either use it with both hands, or sometimes people, like especially in Nepal, Hindus, they often offer you something this way. And so the casual thing, you know, like flinging something or casually whatever, tossing it, is usually not a good idea. Again, students are, you know, people are different. Let me see if there's anything on. Okay, not throw things, we're ready to move on. I did. Oh, shoes. What did I not say about shoes? Yes. So shoes are just considered impure and dirty. And if you had to see our roads and compare them to the roads here, you might understand why. But this is also from of old. So like I remember the first time I saw this American girl pack her bag, and she had her clothes there. Oh, sorry, in her closet. She just had her shoes with her clothes in the closet. And I was like, why are your shoes there? Like, why are your boots with all your clothes? Like, it just seemed like terrible. Like you'd pack your shoes with your clothes because like, shoes are just considered dirty and impure. So you enter a home, you take out your shoes, you enter a temple, you take out the shoes. And if you're having any kind of worship time, it'd be understood like keep your shoes out, you know, because it bring in all the impurities, negative energies, and things like that. So, yeah, so we had to choose. Yeah? Thank you, yes. So books in general, even study books, sometimes they consider, yeah, that's like a holy thing. But definitely the way we treat our Bible is really important when you're having a prayer meeting or a Bible study or a satsang, keeping it on the floor, and putting your coffee cup on it or something is a no-no. Okay. Yeah, or even when they're reading it, even though they're all sitting on the floor, they'll have a stand where they'll put the Bible or the holy books on, so it's not on the floor, not where your feet went. So, okay, now here's a question for the non-Indians in the room. What is allopathic medicine? Who can answer that? Anyone? You've heard this term before? Huh? Pardon? So okay, not closed yet, although the picture is misleading. So anyone else want to try, guess? So allopathic medicine is our term in India, Indian term for Western medicine. What you all consider normal medicine, and you all wouldn't have a name for it, is allopathic medicine. So where you treat symptoms and the disease by giving some kind of drugs or radiation or surgery. And the Ayurvedic medicine is like the Hindu system of health, or and it's all about using diets or natural foods and exercise to and help the body heal itself. So the idea is you don't bring outside toxic things, but you use these very gentle methods that help the body heal. So it's a lot of they have colleges that teach this. It's a very accepted. You get grants from the government. It's not considered like, you know, like somehow the way medicine of that kind would be looked at over here, very on the fringe. Yeah, and they, you know, they have cold remedies. And if you remember the list I gave you is like, how do you bridge with that? How do you learn to affirm? And some are like some great remedies. And I went to the dentist a few days ago, months ago, and for some tooth cleaning, and she gave me like 4 injections of painkillers on the gums. Like, that is overkill. Okay, so like in India, yeah, the idea is always to use the least possible. Like you have to be in serious pain for someone to give you a painkiller. You know, you have to, the idea, and I know like with my Hindu doctor growing up, no matter what the problem was when I went to him, the first thing he said, okay, you have to stop. Are you eating meat and all? Yeah, okay, stop eating meat. That's their first, that's their answer, because meat is like overall such a bad thing for the system, very non-Ayurvedic, and it's like any sickness, okay, the first thing is just, are you, no meat in your diet? And then, you know, like this doctor was like always, everything is yogurt, and he put you on this diet that you would be, you know, pretty miserable. But that's, you know, that's definitely. So meat is definitely considered, even though Hindus that eat meat, it's always like, yes, you're eating meat, but it's like doing something that you know is somewhat, it's like Christians who drink wine in America. It's like you're drinking wine a bit, but you always know that it's a big taboo, and you're maybe, you know, walking some gray area. And anything going wrong in your life, it could be because you've been eating meat. So that's this thing you need to fast from. So anyway, back to Ayurvedic. So Hindus are very open to this. They practice a lot of these remedies. They may miss not having access to some of those medicines for their colds or whatever. And that's just something to keep in mind. And again, like to have a positive attitude, it's like, wow, it is moving to natural health. And there's a lot now in the US about naturopathy and natural health. And so we see it evening out. But in the old days, I mean, people would be just horrified. It's like, what is this? They have a system of hot and cold foods. So you'll suddenly offer something, you know, like a papaya to someone in the hot season and say, no, I can't eat that because it's a hot food. And it's very hot now. It's too heaty and I'll get sick. So they have this idea that in the hot season, you shouldn't eat certain hot food. And in the cold season, you shouldn't have cold foods. And if you have this cold food, you know, and you can Google it if you're interested in knowing which are hot and which are cold. And all I know is that when my son was 2 years old and the summer came on, we like 40 degrees Celsius. What's that in Fahrenheit? 115. He would like, the whole month, he would not eat any of the normal food. He would only eat like rice and cucumber and yogurt and, you know, things like that, which later I was like, you know, he's pretty following the cold food. Like he's not having any of the heat food, he's having the cold food. He never does that anymore, but he went through that phase. So there might be something there. So the other thing is to realize Hindus are just open to all these areas. So numerology, astrology is a very important part of Hindu faith. From the time you're born, there'll be an astrological chart made, charting, you know, which phase of the planets and moon you were born in. And at the time of marriage, also your horoscopes have to match. And if they don't, that's, you know, the whole family will be against the marriage. And they'll probably say, now this is, if you marry someone with this particular horoscope, the marriage will not work out. So you have all these tales of doom and gloom. And that's kind of a big issue. And the good part about that, again, forming bridges, the good part, I think, with all this is that Hindus are open to alternative medicine. They're open to alternative forms of healing. They're open to things of spirituality. And so you can offer to pray for people when they're sick. You can offer to talk about your own spiritual experiences because they have all these spiritual experiences. Of course, the zodiac signs is something like from the West that they've absorbed, but it like fits in with them. All my Hindu friends, they always know what sign of the zodiac they are, and they read their horoscopes and they talk about it. And they can be PhDs and they can be, you know, master's students, and it's fine. All this is held in tension and they have no problem with it. Yes, we've all heard about the arranged marriages. And again, like to go back to the different, curious, affirming, is I read somewhere on the statistic that 53% of all the world's marriages are arranged. Because in a number of, you know, Muslim cultures in Africa and in Asia, they have arranged marriages. And apparently, those arranged marriages have about 6% of them break up. Now, what that means, of course, could also mean that they're often in cultures where women don't have freedom, they don't have ways of supporting themselves, they don't have ways of getting out of an abusive thing, such as a situation. And I just want to put that in there as... Yeah, there is. Yeah. Pardon? Yeah. And as a woman growing up in India, you feel like, wow, you know, we don't have that freedom as a woman, but you also don't see so many broken families. You don't see so many single moms. You don't see so many children in school that have only one parent and are really deeply affected by it. So, so that's, you know, you just have to balance it out and realize, well, I don't need to make fun of this whole arranged marriage, but be aware that sometimes a lot of us, our students that you're dealing with, are under that pressure from your family to get married at a certain time and find a certain wife or find Indian wife of the same caste or the same, yes, you know, belief. So, So these are some of the ceremonies. Maybe they have pre-marriage ceremonies of putting turmeric on the face or putting henna on their hands. Weddings are long affairs, 4 or 5 days of, they have a Sangeet night, some of them, with a lot of dancing and music. So being invited to an Indian wedding is a real sign that they are reaching out to you. You know, they're welcoming you, and that friendship has reached a certain level, and you should go if you can, because that's a fun way to get an inside perspective of the culture. I'm not going to go much into the dowries. Suffice to say that the dowry, which is the giving of a mandatory cash or kind gift as a condition of the marriage, is like been practiced for a long time. It's outlawed in India, and practice goes on. And as even as late as 2012 or something, they had still recorded over 8,000 dowry-related deaths. That these are deaths where the women is, usually the women, is believed to have died due to harassment related to a dowry, that the dowry wasn't enough, and then the husband's family is saying, we want more, you know, we want a car, we want this. So even, again, an outlawed practice, even in modern India, this is not only among like very, very poor situations, it continues to be a big menace. So I'm going to stop here and say, this is a picture of a matrimonial column, okay? Yeah, the papers, you know, now they have websites, okay, so you don't even have to do this. But I just brought it here to say, okay, this is, I mixed my interaction time with what we're talking. So you're going to stop here and think of something, two, three things you see here that you don't understand, and two, three things that show you what are some of the values as people get married, what are they looking for? Yeah.
Even though I thought caste was outlawed a long time ago.
Absolutely, yeah. So caste prejudice is sort of outlawed, but we all know that you cannot outlaw prejudice, correct? It keeps popping up in all kinds of places. So it's not against the law if you're a certain caste to want to marry someone of that caste, but it does show you how important it is in their values. So on one hand, everyone's saying, no, there's no caste, it's all outlawed, and nobody practices. But if you see a matrimonial column, so all these are names of castes, the ones in red. And GSB is a kind of a Brahmin caste. It's a subcaste of the Brahmins. And I have a close friend, a Brahmin girlfriend, who eloped to marry her boyfriend that she met in an architecture firm. Not because he was not a Brahmin, but because he was a different subcaste of the Brahmin, her family didn't approve. You know, so, Shakti, you, yes? Yeah. Yeah.
It's just like race.
Yeah.
Racism, here in the U.S., you know, it's already cannot discriminate.
Yeah.
So I think in India it's the same, yeah. Where the discrimination based on caste is not law.
Yeah.
But caste is just being, yeah, caste of those communities as communities.
Absolutely. Yes. Anything else you see here? Quickly, anyone? Yeah. So it's definitely the fair, the homely. Did you see the homely? Yeah, homely means like home loving, really. You know, doesn't mean, yeah. What about the word manglik? Where is that word? I saw it somewhere. Anyway. Okay. So that's a word that means that your horoscope, your horoscope, you're born under some certain sign of the planet or whatever, and they deem you a manglik. And it's very bad luck for someone who's not a manglik to marry a manglik. So if you do your horoscope and you're a manglik, that means it's going to be very difficult for you to find a spouse, and any marriage will break off, you know, if they try and determine that, you know. And even if you may not be, but that the priest at that time determines from his calculations that you are, that, you know, the marriage is off. So a lot of time, Mangliks advertise so that they can find another Manglik, because that's not bad luck. So So anyway, the importance of education, can you see that? Like education is very important, having a good job. So they mentioned qualifications.
They mentioned height.
Height, yes. That's interesting. Yeah.
I think another thing is sometimes they also, if you have an American education or Western education, that's female.
Oh, definitely. If you're a green card holder, there's a whole section for that. So I just, said, okay, so we have our own version here of dating sites and just to see, okay, what are people looking for? There's no education mentioned. No one's worried about the Manglik or anything. So Bollywood, okay? Bollywood, the term comes from Bombay and Hollywood because before Bombay changed its name to Mumbai. And this is going to be an exciting way to learn about Indian culture or Hindu culture that is like fun and gives you some good, good questions you can ask. These are popular movies with popular actors. Shah Rukh Khan is very famous in the Krish guy, I forget his name. Hrithik Roshan, Amir Khan. So this is like a good way to start conversations, and maybe, if I'm taking you away from Slumdog, this is what I give you in return. But they're just fun to do. And I think what I learned is like, for some time, people, it's like, oh, Hindi movies are too melodramatic, they're too many song and dance. We have all these criticisms. And I remember for me as an Indian, when I first met people from Central Asia and Africa, they told me, we watch Bollywood movies all the time, and they would talk about all these actors and actresses they liked. And I thought, oh, that's such a good way, it's such a good way to affirm, begin a conversation and talk about, movies you like, and it made me more appreciative than of my own culture. So that's a good, just to keep that in mind, like, if you're going to ask some question and you're not sure, but it's a big stereotype, as long as it's an affirming question, that's a better way to begin. Like Mennonites would always ask me about Gandhiji and his peace-loving, and how peace-loving accomplishments and how that changed India, which I don't think the peace really survived in India. The Mennonites did a lot more with it. But it helped me to say, wow, I need to look at this. If all the world is looking at Gandhiji as being nonviolent and peace-loving, how should that shape me as a modern Indian? So it can be a good thing. Are you serious? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they felt he betrayed the country, and that was a big, another thing. Yeah. So, with the festivals, Indians and Hindus have a lot of different festivals, okay? But this is what I want to put before you, is Diwali, for example, which is one of the very big festivals of India, where they celebrate with lights and fireworks, and they do Rangoli, which is... patterns with rice flour and colors on the floor. They give gifts. It's the time where you clean the house because goddess Lakshmi is coming in. Lakshmi is the goddess of wealth and prosperity that is also worshipped at Diwali time. You have new clothes. It's the time you exchange sweets. So it's a big, big celebration that goes on for a few days. And for our students over here, there'll be nothing. Like at Diwali, I go down the street, I'm like, this is just, like there's nothing. And I thought, how does that feel? To be in a country where you are, the biggest festival of your country is going on, but you're in this strange space where nobody knows, nobody greets you, nobody asks you, about it. And so I would say one tip is like, if you can download an Indian calendar onto your, or just Google some of these, the big festivals, that can be so helpful to reach out to your Indian friends and students and say, how are you? You must be missing your family at Diwali, or can I, send a bunch of sweets or just something, to reach out to them and greet them. And I think it's so, Raksha Bandhan.
Depending on whether the first stop is
Yeah, they do. The dates do change. But if you've got it in a calendar, you can ask. Because even living in Pune, I could not tell. Because different, the south and the north, they have different dates. But I ask, is today the day you celebrate Diwali? You know, or see who's, again, observe. When I see them wishing each other, I'm like, okay, this must be the day. So, yeah. Pongal? Yes. So there are other regional festivals also very big, like he mentioned Pongal in the south. In Maharashtra, Ganesh, Chaturthi, Ganesh is a big festival where the elephant god is brought into the house and they're worshipped. There's a lot of puja and worship that happens within the house. And then on the last day, they take them and immerse it in the ocean. And people say over here too, if you go, you know, they go to the Columbus, the beach area, there's people trying to immerse the idols on Ganesh festival. So it's a big festival, and that's something I think as you learn about, it'll give you a good talking point. You can ask, you can wish them, greet them. I did want to mention Raksha Bandhan, because Raksha Bandhan is a time, it's not as big a festival, but it's a time where the sisters tie an amulet or a talisman on the brother's hand and prays for their protection. And the brother would usually give them a gift of some cash or kind. So it's a thing between siblings. And that's another way for all the students over here, maybe their brothers or their sisters are far away, and this is a time when their thoughts would, you know, go back home, and it's something you can ask about or talk about. And sometimes they mail these rakhis, these things are called rakhis, the ones they tie on the hand, and they may mail it. And it's not always with blood brothers. Oftentimes people might have a cousin that they're close to, or maybe some neighbor they grew up with that they think of as a brother, and they might send, you know, sort of a rakhi to them or wish them. So, yeah. Yes, feel free. It is, yeah. It's like a reverse Valentine message, you see. It's like, I really like you, but as a brother, yeah. It is, that's a fun. It is true. Are you serious? I never knew that. See, we are getting the boy's perspective and the girl's perspective. Pardon? What did you say about Valentine? Don't go Valentine's Day. Yeah, you don't want to find out. So anyway, yeah. So Holi is a fun festival where they throw color. And a lot of these have a theme of celebrating good over evil. You know, the demon was defeated and things like that. So, yeah. Anyway, these are the before Dasera is the Navratri, and for the Gujaratis, that's like 9 days where they go, and there's a lot of dancing, and so it can be a fun time. Dandiya. Okay, is this building familiar to anyone? Not you, I sound like anyone. Not you also, anyone else. Okay, Hina, tell them, what is this building? Yes, the name of this building is somebody's personal home, a very rich family. At one time, they were the fifth richest people in the world. And this is their home, their personal home. It's 27 floors, cost, over $2 billion, 400,000 square feet. No two floors are alike, like they're all unique. Even in the interior decor, they don't repeat. If they use one wood here, they haven't. They've got a staff of 600. Six floors are parking. So I just show that to say two things. It's showing you the other side of India. But when I went to visit there, I was curious as an architect student. I want to see, pardon? In Mumbai. Yeah, thank you. Mumbai. Southern Mumbai. So it's a very posh part of town too. And I went to visit there once and I was like, I want to see this building, you know. And when I went there, this might have been 2013 or 12, I found out that they were not living in it. And they hadn't been living in it like for a year or so. And why had it not lived there? Because it was not yet Vastu compliant. So what is vastu? Vastu is kind of like feng shui, yeah, or it's like a system, it's like a science related to the space. I guess they believe that everything in life has positive energies and negative energies, and vastu is a science of organizing space, so to limit the negative energies and allows a lot of the positive energies. It is a nightmare for architects. Even my Hindu architects complain about it. It's like, how can you build a house with these rules that were set in ancient India and now have, you know, very little meaning? But it's very, very important. People just believe it's bad luck. And even the other day, I wrote to my friend who's not even a Hindu. She's a Parsi, which is another religion. And I was just saying, I'm still having trouble with some aspect of my house in India. And she said, you know, you should get the vastu done for your house. You have all these problems because you have not made your house vastu compliant. So it's like a big belief as to which part the kitchen is, where you put your idols, and you know where you put the entrance. So these are things that really shape culture and everyday behavior. Okay, so I'm just going to stop with these questions here. The first one's obvious. If I were to go to the international students, I've got 1 hour, and I show all the, you know, can I get them ready to understand America? Are they ready? Would they be ready, you think? So what is helpful? Okay, what is helpful when you have a brief knowledge of another culture? What can be harmful about it? Okay, I'm going to leave you to talk at your tables about these questions for a few minutes. Okay, but when I'm at the end, I want to hear back some ideas for the last question. Can we do that? Maybe Chris and I forget your name. Are we losing you? Okay. So two by two or at a table, just discuss what is harmful, what can be helpful. What are some ways to learn about another country and avoid sort of stereotyping in a negative way? Just take a few minutes. Okay, I want you to specifically talk about this last question. If you can't see it, what do you think is the best way to learn about people from another culture or religion in a way that avoids stereotyping? Okay, so I want to hear some suggestions. So if you all haven't done that question, I'm just saying start with that. I love the buzz, yeah. I know for me, it helped me. I had these two characters in YWAM, both were Americans, that became symbolic to me of that idea, because the one guy, I'll just call him Tom, he was super interested in Hinduism. He researched, he knew every aspect of Hinduism and Hindu rituals and details, and he collected resources and books and whatever. And then I have this other leader who was like this typical loud, gregarious American, who always had his jeans and flannels on and, you know, just the kind of person you'd never see really doing the contextualization thing. But the difference is the first guy is like, I thought the Indian guys didn't like him. And he didn't seem to enjoy them either. But he had all this information. He'd got all the rituals and routines down. But the other guy is like, he spent time, he knew people by their name, he would talk to them, he would slap them on the back, give them big hugs, whatever, you know, like as American as you could wish, but it's like he had this relationship, everybody, like they loved him, and they, you know, they all thought he was like their best friend. And I keep that in mind, because it's so easy sometimes when you're talking about these things to lose sight of that, the relational aspect. So good. Anyone else? To be relational, yeah? Common ground, yeah. I like that.
Hey, sorry, again, not just so people can hear, but we're actually recording.
Oh, okay. That's awkward, holding a microphone here in a small room. So, like coming from a Chinese background, I can see a lot of cultural values and similarities between the two cultures, although we practice it differently. And also we mentioned about individual person can have different situation, but we all come from the same context. Yeah. So I think there are a lot of common topics, like how the issues in the family and about all these things you have talked about, and then maybe we have different point of view. So for me, I think that's a very good starting point, and to understand how they think about it. Yeah,
I like this. Two very good ideas: a common ground and being relational. Anyone else?
I would say we were just talking about this. Instead of making statements about the culture, ask questions, because people usually have heard one thing, like they'd ask me, have you ridden an elephant? And I have not ridden an elephant, but it's just like this one thing, you know, about India. And is making statements rather than asking things, or, oh, this must be really cold for you because India is really hot, right? Like, no, actually, India, I mean, depending on where you are in India, the weather is different. So, doing that is helpful, I think.
Absolutely. My son was telling me yesterday when I was asking some advice, and he says, actually, sometimes when you hear someone is from a different country, we always like want to, we remember some tidbit we heard about that country, we always want to show. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, isn't it, you know, it's cheese or whatever, you know. And sometimes you can be lucky with that, but oftentimes you're going, you know, into the stereotype. And I know when I first came here, I travel and people ask me about the Buckeye team and the football team, and I'm like, okay, I just moved actually to Columbus, and so I had to learn a bit more.
She was asking a good question. She goes to, do you want to mention your situation
about the altar? Oh yeah, my neighbor who's been in America for many years, she has an altar in her home. And I've gone over there many times, but I haven't talked to her about it. So we were just discussing what would be the right way to bring that up and to ask her to tell me what she loves about her religion, and also then to maybe ask her about the God that she worships and what she loves about the God that she worships, to kind of open up the door and start a discussion.
We had got some professional coach training, and when they train you as a coach, they train you to ask good questions. And the best question, if you don't know what else to say, is tell me more about whatever, you know, so you're very open-ended. And, Chris, you had anything to add, or who's got the mic?
That's good.
What about you guys here? Anything you want to add to the...
We were just sharing how the same thing as Smita said, that don't assume things, but ask. And I think that that gives them a chance to share something that they probably may not share with you, but because you ask, they kind of like, it opens up the door for them.
Good.
Another possibility is something to discuss with them is ask them about their perceptions of your culture, because sometimes you can understand things, and you know, how do you see what you see here? And then it opens the door also to talk about maybe the way you see things over there. Start sharing your own cross-cultural experiences and gaining a better understanding, at least an empathy of, you know, what they're going through being here or us being there.
That's a good way, and I think that's a good way. And even Adichie in her single story, I don't know if you'll have to just be taking questions soon, mentioned that sometimes seeing your own cultural weaknesses or cultural issues that people have stereotypes about, and when they're stereotyping you, is the best way actually to think, oh yeah, this doesn't feel so good, you know. So people, they have their own cultures. They'll ask us, is everyone in America obese? We see all these pictures, and you know, they have their own stereotype, and they're like, okay, let's move away. So you'll give some very good ideas, and I just put a few here that I'm gonna say, okay, watching Hindi movies can be a good way to say, hey, I like something about your culture, it's fun, and talk about what you liked about the movie, eating out Indian food, so that you become more familiar, you know, with, if you don't do it often enough, of course, those of us from Indian background do it. Watch cricket, okay? Just like I cannot sound intelligent about American football, You know, I had to learn, and it's like, okay, but it's like maybe watch a game of cricket, one day cricket or something, or an hour of it, or watch it with an Indian friend. The calendar, I already spoke about that, maybe downloading the calendar. Just to go back to the New Year thing, remember that like the Hindus have their own New Year, and a lot of people from other religions, like the Chinese, also have their own New Year. So that's another thing to be aware of so that you can really reach out to your students. Read a book, read a couple of books by Indian authors. That's a great way to learn something. Go look at a map, look at the top 10 cities, try and figure out where things are, because sometimes it's hard to talk about a country, you know, and you're like, is that north, is that south, is that near Mumbai? So, like, get your bearings. Try eggless cake recipes. It's a great way, because a lot of Indians, they may not eat eggs, so you can bake this wonderful cake and then find nobody's going to eat it. I would have these birthday parties and go all out, and then all these my kids' friends would come, and they would like, okay, I have a cold, so you can't have a cold drink when you have a cold in India. You would not have a cold Pepsi. So, okay, so you're not going to drink anything, and then this thing has eggs, so I'm not going to eat. It's like, okay, I have to get better next time. Lorne, you want to say something? Okay, and then there are Times of India, which is a newspaper. Every now and then, go look at what are the headlines, what's happening. So you get a different perspective, a more rounded, a balanced story. So it's not the single story, but it's like, it's not like the Slumdog or some of those things are false, but you're getting more rounded. Which one? DDOJ? He didn't watch it. Oh, okay. Okay.
But the latest one that you can watch is Dangal.
Dangal is on Netflix. I just watched it. It's fun. Pardon? Kabhi Khushi Kabhi Gham. Yeah.
Any other bit around
that? I had put some before, the Kalho. I don't know. Yeah, but I wasn't going back to the storyline. Some movies are more like go into weddings and have a lot more of the culture than others. Kabhi Khushi Kabhi Gham. Yeah. Yeah, how will you? Oh, yeah. Thank you. Okay, can you have you write it for them?
By the way, it's 11:25.
Yes. Okay. So I'm just putting up the
11:25.
Yeah. I just want to stop. You said I could go a bit longer since you started late. Who had questions? Let's go to the questions. Yeah. I'll take a few questions now. Sorry, I was planning to go over a little bit. Did you have a question? You want to talk about your roadblock or? Yeah, okay, so the first thing is because Hindus have so many gods, and when you start telling them about Christ and move them towards accepting Christ as their personal Lord and Savior and making a prayer, a lot of times people are very open to that and they do that, but it could be like they're just thinking, I've got all these gods and I'm adding Christ to that.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is my question. Yeah. And then some people in an extended family, they may not take down all the idols because of the family around, so it isn't always an indication. But doing some discipleship, what we found is it's easier to do like a bridge discipleship with them, like meet them in their home or at a coffee place and go to some like basic discipleship lessons or Bible stories. Before you bring them to a church or a normal American discipleship group, because, you know, that can then, you know, that reluctance to be part of an organized Christian community or a big group, and, you know, you can allay some of the fears. Yeah. And I don't know whether, yeah, Shakti, invite them. We do have some that are very contextual. So we have like a whole contextual movement that has worship songs and the Bible written with Hindu terminology that they would understand. I don't know. Maybe we could. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, so I mean that could be a way. Yeah, but that's great. It is going to be a process. I think in our hearts, all of us, we're so anti-idolatry, and we always assume that someone's going to make that prayer of commitment, and then tomorrow they're going to let it go. But it's a process. I think you need to know that the discipleship is a process. And as they get revelation, as you do the Bible studies, then at the point they're ready, they're going to take them down, you know. Yeah. And the hard part is that if, you know, there's a lot of pressure sometimes to the Christian community to do that, to like cut your ties, immediately stop doing that, take out your idols. Sometimes people say, change your name, come here, come there. But the problem with that is then they don't have that community, and often the Christians don't really welcome them because they're a bit suspicious of them. So, okay. One more question, or what's your name? Scott was asking about the concepts of karma and dharma and how do Hindus interact with that. I think that would be, I'm going to let you roll that over to Shakti. Yeah. Anyone had a quick question about just like the ordinary behavior, customs, food, hospitality, things that you experience with students, something that you want to talk about or ask quickly? But I think just with that area, just because it's so entrenched in India that actually a lot of Christians, more nominal Christians, like that follow the stuff, like they do zodiac signs and they'll go to an astrologer and they'll get their palm read and they'll do all the stuff because it's so common, and the church does not teach enough about it, that it's, you know, about the dangers of that, so they don't always know. So at some point, there might be, you know, a Bible story, as you talk about King Saul, or, you know, consulting the dead woman, or places to actually talk about what is the Christian perspective on witchcraft and all these things, or, you know, because they wouldn't know, and they wouldn't necessarily easily get convicted. So thank you very much, and I'd love to talk to you more in lunchtime or whenever.